Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on nuclear suicide when we come back. You know, the genocidal policy of this global 2000 and New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion. Jesus of Nazareth held that same view. And he said so in Matthew 24, verse 22, with these words when he said, "Except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive." Now, there are 64 of these life-threatening problems described in the scripture detailing this New World Order and their global 2000 genocide agenda. And the scripture teaches preparation for this kind of great tribulation, not just apathy and indifference. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and to survive this global 2000, this New World Order nightmare. Now, if you'd like to do just that, why don't you call, write, or email the law school and ask for those 64 life-threatening problems from the scripture. Let's talk about formulating a real, meaningful, intelligent plan to survive Global 2000 and the other 64 life-threatening problems which are called the Great Tribulation in Scripture. Why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. And our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Now, for those of you that have computers and you're online, you can get that free General Law CD package now off of our website. We've had so many requests, and I've been so busy, I haven't had time to get as many out as I'd like to. So if you've got that CD on order, if you've called me and said, "Hey, where's that CD?" go to our website, and you can download it right off of our website now. We've put it up online. Last time we were talking about Joel Skousen's book. Now, I reviewed this book once before, so if you go back in our archives and look up Strategic Relocation, you'll find the first series of programs on this book. Joel Skousen lives in Orem, Utah. He comes from a long list of conservative writers who have written a number of books on conservative issues, politics, and so on, communism. Now, this Skousen, Joel Skousen, specializes in putting together retreats for people. This is a guy that lives in Los Angeles, and he needs to get out of Los Angeles and move his operation, let's say, to Orem, Utah, or Provo, or Cheyenne, Wyoming, or someplace else, out of harm's way. And he does that for a living, so if you're of a mind or a bent, and you've got the money to do it, and you say to yourself, "Well, yeah, I'd like to have a retreat someplace away from the major metropolitan areas." Now, there's 150 of these major metropolitan areas in the United States that you should be thinking about evacuating. Places like Los Angeles and Chicago, New York, Miami, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, so on. All over America, there are major metropolitan areas. It doesn't mean they're all going to get nuked. It means that when food and supplies are cut off, there's going to become civil unrest. Just picture yourself trying to survive after Hurricane Katrina. Your house is flooded out in New Orleans, and you're going to have to, over the next 4 years, fend for yourself. No FEMA, no government aid, no low-interest loans. Just where are you going to sleep, and what are you going to eat tomorrow? Now, that's a problem that you need to face. And, of course, if you face it front and center, you can probably do something about it. Now, many people will call me and they'll say, yeah, but, you know, I'm poor and I can't afford to do that. Well, it's probably true. You probably can't call somebody to have them come build you a house with a fallout shelter in it. Or relocate from your job where you are right now to someplace, you know, 100 or 200 miles away. You probably don't have those kinds of resources. But what else can you do in your present location to increase your chances of survivability? There will be survivors in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. There were survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I think anybody would agree that if you knew that Nagasaki and Hiroshima were going to be nuked, that it would be in your best interest, at least on that day, to get the hell out of Dodge. I don't think you need to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. Now, you may not know what day that's going to occur, but Jesus made an observation in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. He says, when you see these things coming to pass, you'll know that it's right at the door. When you get news reports that Moscow and St. Petersburg and major metropolitan areas are something's happening, something's going on that's a little different in Russia and China, that'll be a signal, won't it? And when you hear that there's rumblings of war in the air, remember the Cuban Missile Crisis back in the early 1960s? Most of you people probably can't remember. That was before your time, but for those of us that are old-timers, we can remember the fear that we all had. Is this the big one? Is this the big kahuna? As it turned out, it wasn't. But those were the days when you might want to have thought about leaving New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles for an extended period, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, until this thing blows over. And, you know, over time, it blew over. And then you can go back home. But do you want to stay there and take the chance? Now, last time we were talking about this phony collapse of the Soviet Union. And that thing was about as phony as a $3 bill. It was poorly put out. And not nearly as good as the Twin Towers fraud. I mean, that was fair to middling good. But now that we've had an opportunity to review the tapes, and we can see that those buildings were imploded, that they were taken down, that was an inside job. That one's you know, pretty plain. But it was a better job than the Soviet Union collapse. Listen to this. Talking about war and invasion on page 124, all of the 8 men who composed the junta were only mid-level communist leaders when they were appointed by Gorbachev to their new highest-level government posts. None of them were powerful military or KGB leaders before they took charge. People don't rise to be the top men in the mafia by being chosen. They're not elected. They rise by ruthlessly killing their opponents. And so it is with communism. Then second, after this failed coup against Gorbachev, the entire hierarchy of this supposed most powerful leaders in the Soviet Union were forced to flee. If these men really were heads of the KGB, the Defense Ministry, the Interior Police, and the Communist Party, why did they have to flee? Who were they running from? Were they running from their own men under their own control? Even Gorbachev himself was only a middle-level arms control official when he was suddenly vaulted into the premiership. Now, any rational skeptic would take such as evidence that there are others behind the scenes that are really running the show. Someone had to pick Gorbachev. Is it not he that chooses other men that are the real leaders behind the scenes? Remember, in a rise-by-murder system, it is almost impossible to rise from middle-level positions to the top all in one jump. There are too many men with real power on top who must die off or be eliminated, and there's no indication of any mass slaughtering during Gorbachev's rise to power, or in his reshuffling of the cabinet of ministers. It's my assessment that Gorbachev was a front man. Gorbachev was selected for his ability to act the part of a pro-Western, reluctant communist. The coup was implemented when Gorbachev was out of the country, which is highly uncharacteristic of an intelligent coup. He was never arrested or even threatened by the KGB or military forces. Was the KGB really that incompetent? The same organization that with consummate skill and patience has now penetrated every government and media source in the world? I don't believe it for a minute. And then there's Yeltsin and other so-called pro-democracy leaders. They were not arrested in the night prior to the coup, but they were allowed to rally the people without any hindrance at all. Television and telephone lines were not cut off, which allowed Yeltsin freedom to communicate. And remember as well that Yeltsin was the former head of the Communist Party in Moscow. Does the West blindly believe that a man rises to such a position in the communist hierarchy through benign and democratic means? Virtually every high communist leader has blood on his hands. At least the second-hand variety that comes from sending men to Lubyanka and onward to the Gulag archipelago. And then the military made only a token show of force with a few armored personnel carriers, bashing a few buses in front of the parliament, which made for good camera footage for the eager Western media. But is the Soviet military really as inept and unsure of itself as we have been led to believe? Where is the historical evidence, past or present, of Soviet units failing to act in total unity with a unified Soviet command? And then the Western television media said all of the right things almost as if they were reading it all from a script. They told us that Gorbachev had warned us in the West that this would happen if aid was not forthcoming. That primed the public mentally to get ready to give massive aid when the coup is miraculously undone the next day. Second, the coup was not a sure thing, that it might be overthrown by the popular will of the people, indicating the press knew in advance, for there had never been or ever been a failed Soviet coup before. That would justify such a prognostication. And the press was primed that Gorbachev's departure was a great loss, recounting his great contributions to world peace, priming both Western and Russian people to view him more sympathetically upon his hopeful return. And then, finally, that this was an unconstitutional seizure of power, implying that the Soviet Constitution, which institutionalizes the communist one-party state, is somehow on a par with the Western democratic constitutions. Now, this rhetorical game took on even greater levels of idiocy when President Bush announced to the world, upon the coup's apparent failure, that constitutional authority had returned to power and that the right-wing coup had failed. Now think about that. How can any communist coup be anything but radically left-wing? Left-wing, not right-wing. Now, like some great self-fulfilling prophecy, all that the media foretold came to pass in one day. Not once did the media ever question the veracity of their communist sources of information. Not once did the Western press ever question the anomalies and contradictions that surrounded this botched coup, only to make naive and ubiquitous remarks about how this whole series of events proves that the back of the Soviet military has been broken and that the KGB is no longer a significant power, which then set the stage for another propaganda coup that we in the West can now safely disarm because there is now no nuclear threat. This phony nature of the coup, coupled with what appears to be Western media complicity, brings into question whether the demise of communism in Eastern Europe was in fact a reality or simply another illusion. That the people in Eastern Europe have legitimate longings for liberty is not in question. But what is truly in question is whether this so-called former communists, who now have been elected in hastily arranged elections, which give little time for organizing any truly effective opposition, are not in reality simply playing a phony role as well. This so-called reformed government of Romania and Yugoslavia are the most clear examples of old tyrants in a new and different set of clothes. East Germany made a near total reform by unification with West Germany, but not without secret under the table agreements with the Soviets to allow the communists to maintain all of the military and financial advantages of the former arrangements, with the West Germans now picking up the bill in place of the Russians. Erich Honecker, the former East German communist chancellor, revealed before he died in exile in Chile that he was ordered to step down by officials in Moscow and to allow the student demonstrations to go forth in Leipzig. Yeltsin and his group of reformers are also former communists who had never come clean with a full confession of their evil acts and who most probably are playing the role of Team B, with Gorbachev playing the role as Team A, to pacify the freedom movements within Russia so that legitimate anti-communist leaders never emerge. When one team becomes unpopular, the leaders can switch support to Team B and avert a popular uprising. Now, I believe that only in the Baltic states, in Belarus, and in Georgia was there originally any legitimate anti-communist leadership, which was not part of the communist tyranny of the past. But all were eventually overthrown by these reformed communists under suspicious and non-democratic circumstances. Much as we would like to believe otherwise, in the euphoria of the appearance of liberty reborn in Russia and the Eastern European satellite countries, let us never forget the time-honored lessons of history. Old tyrants never fade away on their own volition. They must die or they must be overthrown. To that we might now add a new lesson to history. Do not trust former friends and co-workers of tyrants to champion the cause of liberty. Now here's the evidence of Russian deceit since taking over the former Soviet position. Russian scientist and recent defector Vil Mirzayanov, spelled Mirzayanov, revealed that Russia is continuing to develop and build new chemical and new biological weapons in violation of the Chemical Weapons Treaty ban. Second, Russia continues to support Middle Eastern terrorist groups with explosives, ammunition, and high-tech training. Three, Russia continues to sell nuclear technology to at least five different countries, all of which are sworn enemies of the United States, such as Iran. Four, Russia continues to build new intercontinental ballistic missiles in violation of the INF Treaty. 5. The U.S. paid millions to Russia for the disarming of all of the Ukraine's obsolete nuclear missiles, and then allowed Russia to take possession of all of the warheads, which can now be restockpiled and reused. 6. The supposed conventional forces reduction on the part of the Russians is equally deceptive. They negotiated for and they received agreement from the United States that any Eastern Bloc and Russian military equipment moved beyond the Ural Mountains would be considered dismantled. These massive weapon stockpiles are clearly still available for future conflict. They've just been relocated. 7. In 1996, it was revealed by anonymous U.S. intelligence agents that Russia is continuing to build a huge underground military complex in the Ural Mountains with a total subterranean land area the size of Washington, D.C.'s metro area. This facility at Yamanto Mountain includes underground bunkers, nuclear launch facilities, and even nuclear missile factories and assembly areas on a huge scale. This not only is a violation of their stated intent, but all of the verification provisions of past treaties. 8. In violation of the 1972 ABM Treaty, they have installed a system of mobile interceptors that are moved every week. Number 9. It was revealed by the Washington Times in April of 1997 that Russia is building four more underground nuclear shelters in and around Moscow, all for the elite military and government leadership. I might point out that here in Washington, D.C., Camp David, Maryland, and other secret locations around the country, the leadership of the elite military and government leadership of the United States is doing the same thing. 10. Russia claims to have stopped targeting U.S. cities, which is a lie. Even if it's true, it's totally meaningless. It takes less than 15 minutes to retarget a missile. 11. Russia has increased industrial and military spying by nearly double, according to FBI sources. And 12. Russian submarines continue to stalk and practice attack maneuvers on the U.S. Navy at sea. A Russian spy trawler in U.S. waters between Washington State and Vancouver Island was laying in wait for an incoming Trident submarine when it was spotted and photographed by a Canadian military helicopter with U.S. Navy observers aboard. The Russians fired a laser at them to stop their picture taking and nearly blinded several personnel. And then finally, under the terms of the 1992 Mutual Security Treaty, signed mostly under duress by the former Soviet republics, Russian troops are now being stationed at their host's expense in the Ukraine, Georgia, Belarus, and all others except the Baltic states and Azerbaijan. Now, if it isn't already obvious to you, let me paint for you a very clear picture by asking some very critical questions. First, why do the Russians desperately want to limit our ballistic missile defenses to below 3,000 feet a second if they do not intend to launch a first strike someday? Second, why continue to build an expensive cluster of underground bunkers and nuclear protection facilities unless you want to ensure your ability to continue a nuclear war after starting one? And three, why would you continue to build chemical and biological weapons in direct violation of a treaty if you don't intend to use them? And four, why do the Russians continue to lie, deceive, and delay the U.S. treaty compliance inspectors if they don't have anything to hide? But here are some even more troubling questions. Why did the Bush administration pursue a more restrictive ABM treaty when they had many defectors from the Russian side telling them of Russia's open violations of the old treaty? Why didn't the U.S. demand the dismantling of Russia's huge ABM system, and most advanced in the world it is, as reciprocity for Russia's similar demands upon the United States? And why has every U.S. administration, both Democrat and Republican, refused to prosecute any past treaty violations or even report them to the American people? Why have they classified these violations as top secret and then prohibited all of the intelligence agencies from revealing these blatant lies? And third, why does the U.S. continue to disarm when U.S. authorities know the Russians are reciprocating, or worse, allowing Russia and China military people to have special briefings and nearly open access to all of our top secret facilities, both military and private? And why does the U.S. government ship by way of special air courier from Kennedy Airport every week millions in U.S. currency to Russia, all in crisp new $100 bills? I think you'll find an interesting correlation between these bills and the ones Europeans complain are flooding their countries at the hands of hundreds of big-spending Russia mafia chiefs. Now, I will reserve my unpleasant response for the section on government threat. The bottom line is that we are headed for the worst war in the history of the world, and you can rest assured that it's coming. And I believe in the second decade of the next century, when Russian and Chinese rearmament is complete. The United States has already decommissioned all 50 Peacekeeper MX missiles, which were our only land-based missiles capable of penetrating Russian hardened targets, even though the Russians reneged on their portion of the Strategic Reduction of Forces Agreement. It has agreed to stop keeping nuclear-armed B-52s on alert. We have removed the nuclear capabilities of the B-1 bomber and the entire naval fleet. We have agreed to no longer build Trident submarine bases except for those already located in Bangor, Maine, Seattle, Washington, and Kings Bay, Georgia, and to keep half of our submarines in port at any given time. So this makes it easy for the Russians to target those submarines in port, half of our fleet. And in the interim years, our billions in foreign aid will continue to save their economy and bolster their secret defense spending. Now, is this suicide or what? It's worse than that, I fear. The world has never witnessed such a well-planned surprise nuclear attack as we are going to experience at the hands of the Russian and Chinese communists sometime in the future, after we have provoked enough hatred in the world through our constant military intervention to justify Russia and China taking down the United States of America, the world's biggest bully. And I'm convinced that the communist leaders are still fully in control of all of the real levers of power in Russia and the former Soviet states that possess significant weapons systems. The other less strategic states have been let go in Eastern Europe with a mere semblance of independence, simply because the Russians know they can easily be retaken at will without any significant struggle. That is the main reason why Yeltsin protests so loudly at the idea of the former satellites joining NATO. The Russians intend to take them back in the future, and they do not want them armed. Although having some sleepers as members of NATO certainly enhances the Russians' ability to sabotage and to spy on NATO and NATO preparations for defense. Now, how's that for openers? Now, it's the halfway point, so let me give you a reminder here that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not its 8 schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, for those of you that are online, you can go to our website and you can download our free 4-hour introductory CD package yourself, free, on our website. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing a book called Strategic Relocation. Now, we've reviewed this book before, Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places, second edition by Joel M. Skousen. You can get a copy for yourself, and I don't know what the price is. I'm going to, it'll be around $20, $30, something like that. Well worth the $20 or $30. I recommend it wholeheartedly. His email is joels@joelskousen.com. Now, his last name is spelled S-K-O-U-S-E-N. So the email address is Joels, J-O-E-L-S, at joelskousen.com. Telephone number is 801-224-4746. Once more, that's area code 801-224-4746. You can call, ask what the price is. Or you can write, if you prefer, to Joel Skousen, 290 West, 580 South, Orem, O-R-E-M, Utah, 84058. Once more, that's 290 West, 580 South, Orem, Utah, 84058. All right, we are reviewing the book Strategic Relocation under Section 2, Threat Analysis, with specific emphasis, not specifical now, but specific emphasis on nuclear suicide. The United States is in the process of committing nuclear suicide, as I reported to you in the first chapter. Now let's take a look at this phony concept that the Soviet Union and communism is dead. Now, he goes on to say, I have presented to you the general class of recent evidence that I possess. But ultimately, you must follow your own feelings. None of it is so clear-cut that you can run to your friends and say, I have proof. We are dealing here with a masterfully kept secret. There is tremendous internal political pressure being kept upon existing intelligence agencies to keep their people muzzled about all of the disturbing counter-evidence that they see in their daily reports. However, what you do with all of this is up to you. My recommendations for your strategic safety will take considerable time and money to implement, and thus will probably not be taken very seriously unless you feel strongly committed to this very unpleasant potential. I got to pause there for a moment. It is true. It takes time, effort, and energy to prepare for anything. And unless you believe that there is a threat here, it's kind of like riding on the Titanic. Do you believe that this ship is, in fact, sinkable? Well, hell, most people didn't believe it. They didn't think the Titanic could be sunk. It was advertised as being unsinkable, the greatest technological marvel of the age. So they didn't even put enough lifeboats on there for everybody. And the lifeboats they put on, they finally put on half enough lifeboats because they figured that ships need the lifeboats, if for nothing else, just for the sight. You should have a ship, you know, a luxury liner should have lifeboats on it. Just like a luxury liner should have a Class A restaurant, well, it should have lifeboats. People expect it. It's kind of like going into a 7-Eleven store. We expect there to be milk in the cooler, and so we stock milk in the cooler, not because it makes us any money, but because the public expects it to be there. We make our money on beer and cigarettes, but we stock milk back there just so that when people come in here, we can claim to be a grocery store. 7-Eleven isn't a grocery store. It's a beer and cigarette store. 70% of all the sales that they make in those 7-Eleven stores are made in beer and tobacco. They put gasoline out there to draw you in, and they have milk in the cooler. But those are expected for grocery stores. Their real business is selling alcohol and tobacco. They should be called 7-Eleven alcohol and tobacco stores. But who in the hell wants to frequent a tobacco or alcohol store? Now, he goes on to say, it's my general feeling that the Russians have a certain window of opportunity to strike in the future. This window is defined by the maximum disarmament that they can get the West to achieve, and the maximum strength that they can build secretly. When these two aspects reach the highest point of advantage for the Russians, that's when they will strike, taking into consideration as well China's growing capability, which will attack and control the Pacific Rim nations. So I estimate the timing of the next world war to be somewhere around 2009 to 2015. The Russians are really worried about ballistic missile defenses, since their entire strategy is built upon a massive first strike. Even though Congress keeps pushing for some type of system, I think the power brokers have a sleeper inside the Republican Party. In addition, I believe the Russians can only maintain this reform deception a little while longer, given the economic problems in the former Soviet Union. The continued central control of railroads and heavy transport needed for future military purposes exacerbates the growing facade of free market reforms in Russia. Lack of transportation is one of the key elements keeping meaningful Western investment away from Russia. The so-called reforms are presently faltering badly due to massive corruption from former communists who have been given ownership of key elements of the economic infrastructure and privatized companies, coupled with growing crime, both organized and disorganized, and general public unrest. These deteriorating economic factors indicate that the communists, which I believe are still in full control and power, cannot continue this ruse indefinitely. They must strike before the economy crumbles, or before the Russians' limited experience with liberty blossoms to something dangerous. Fortunately, for the underground communist leaders, the Russian people are showing a very strong addiction to the old relics of communist pampering and security, albeit in near poverty. At least they could drink themselves dizzy every night and not have to be subjected to the judgments of a free market. Believe me, most Russians aren't real keen on liberty and long for the prideful good old days when Soviet power was respected and feared. So what is the reason behind all of this deception and the continued preparations to strike the West with a massive nuclear first strike? There are some possible Russian motives. First, the Russians reap the benefits of having the West take over the financial support and subsistence of their former Eastern European satellite states, which was causing a tremendous drain on Soviet Russian resources. Second, they intend to milk all of the aid that they can get from the naive or the duplicitous Western governments. This aid allows them to secretly continue to channel internal funds to their secret military projects and to continue to build up foreign client states that will join in the attack on the West. Countries like North Korea, Iran, Syria, and others. Now, the former communist hierarchy is being enriched by their temporary switch into organized crime, which now supports the elite lifestyle they used to enjoy as the nomenklatura in the Soviet Union. Third, their ultimate intent is to conquer Europe without a destructive fight, so as to be able to harness this huge economic engine in behalf of communism, which cannot sustain itself without external economic support. They intend, I believe, to launch a massive nuclear surprise attack without any warning upon U.S. military targets after an appropriate trigger event, probably in some country in the Middle East or perhaps in Korea or Taiwan. I do not think that they intend to invade or occupy the United States, mainly because of the deterrence of so many private arms in the hands of citizens and the distances that are involved. It would be a Vietnam for the Russians in terms of long supply lines. Such a strategy, demonstrating maximum nuclear force in a surprise attack, is intended to induce Europe to capitulate without a fight, which wouldn't be difficult to imagine given the sorry state of European morale and character. Furthermore, I believe the most probable timing of such an attack is in the late fall to midwinter, when the Russians have the greatest advantage to exploit the ground offensive in Europe, being the most experienced country, the most experienced army in deep winter operations. Heavy European weather during this period also enhances their abilities to move undetected once Western satellites have been blinded or destroyed. However, I do not believe that this plan will succeed, and although it will take many years, I think the West will once again rally in due time and then beat the Russians. The Russians cannot sustain a long, protracted war. But the results of this next war will be so devastating that it is going to destroy the last vestiges of opposition in the West to the emerging and all-controlling New World Order, a worldwide government, which would seem to be the ultimate purpose of this war. What will come afterward in terms of international regulation and control, I fear, will be far more destructive of liberty and national sovereignty than anything in the history of the world that we've observed or experienced so far. Another very dangerous problem will come out of the conspirators' implementation of the old dialectic or Hegelian strategy to defeat Russia. As in World War II, where the West built up Russia to help defeat the Germans, so the West will accelerate arming Red China, who will feign then being an ally in order to become the next military colossus. Those that conspire to build an international one-world government know they always need a new threat to cause nations of the world to give up sovereignty for apparent protection. China will become that new threat after World War III to make sure that all nations allow the new world regime, the United Nations, to maintain the same powerful army that was used to defeat Russia, an army and police force that will then be used to control its own people more than threaten China. We'll take a look at more on that later. So there you have it. It is an unpopular and a very uncomfortable assertion. And indeed, it goes against what every single American government official would be willing to confirm. This is clearly a very controversial issue, but you cannot trust your leader's opinion. Not only are they consummate yes men to the establishment, but they are also practiced liars. And if they weren't, they wouldn't have been allowed to make it into the halls of power in the first place. Now remember, in our first program, we took a look at this concept of nuclear suicide. Nuclear suicide. The United States has already played nuclear suicide. We're not here talking about the if we don't do this, this is what's going to happen. Hell, we have already done it, past tense. It's a done deal. When is it coming? Skousen thinks between 2009 and 2015. Well, that's over the next 5 or 6 years. His theory is that when the Russians have succeeded in persuading the West to disarm as much as they can get us to do, and at the same time, they have built up all of their strength to the maximum apex, that will be the most opportune time for them to strike. Now, Dr. Teller, remember, had his observations were that the West ought not to show any weakness at all, that we should be prepared to live through, to win a nuclear war, and if you guys give us any static, then here's what we're going to do, and we'll probably do it first. That keeps your enemy off guard, off balance, and on defense. Now, we've decided we're not going to do that. We're going to absorb a first strike. Well, now, boys and girls, if you absorb this whole first strike, then they're going to destroy your ability to strike back with their first strike, aren't they? Think about this. Now, let's be intelligent people. The Russians know that there is a silo with a nuclear missile in it in Montana aimed at Moscow. Well, then, wouldn't the Russians want to knock that missile out so that we couldn't launch it against Moscow? Which is the purpose for the massive first strike. Well, now that we've agreed that we're not going to launch that missile, when we see their missiles in the air, we're going to wait until their missiles strike our missile in Montana and destroy it. Which means then there isn't going to be a second strike. Or there's not going to be as big a second strike, is there? Now, I know you're probably sitting there saying, oh my God. That's right, this is one of those, oh my God. That's what Noah's flood was. It was one of those, oh my God. That's what the Egyptian army was facing at the Red Sea crossing. That's what Sodom and Gomorrah were facing. And that's what the Great Tribulation is all about. That's what you and I are facing. Here it comes. That's what the people on the Titanic were facing. That's what the people in New Orleans were facing with Hurricane Katrina. I mean, come on, boys and girls, this is where life really is. There are these, oh my God, events. That's the way life is. Now, let me go back here on this nuclear suicide. Remember, we were talking about the existing weapons infrastructures and the weapons deployment sites and so on. Well, they've got test sites and existing weapons infrastructures and so on that we, all of us, ought to be familiar with. I mean, you know, each and every one of us should know where in the world or where in our sphere of the world are options. Is it in Isabella, Missouri or Kansas City? So from my perspective, I take a look at it and say, should I move out of Missouri? The answer is no. There are two nuclear targets in the state of Missouri. Both of them are far enough away from where I am that it's not a problem to me. So I'm sitting here saying, well, I think that I'll weather the storm right here where I'm at. Now, there are places in Missouri that are downwind from these two sites. If you're downwind within 100 miles of Kansas City or the B-1 bomber base up in the north end of the state, then you need to take that into consideration. Now, Skousen goes through every county in the United States. That's your county, wherever you're located, and he grades it. It can be A+, A, A-, B+, B, B-, C. He doesn't go below C. Once you're in a C location, you know that's average. That's you're on your own. That's you're taking your life in your hands. But, you know, there's a potential there for you. That's a pretty valuable part of the book. It covers the last chapter. I'm going to take a minute here and I'm going to go through and explain that to you. I'm just taking a look here. Just open the book up and then where it says New Hampshire. looking at New Hampshire, a small state in New England, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 counties. 10 counties. He lists the total population, the people per square mile, the number of whites, blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and Native Americans, serious crime, property crime, the percentage of Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and Libertarians. Going through this, we have a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13-part test for your county. So if we were to take the just a county called Coos County, New Hampshire, population 33,111, which gives you 17.9 people per square mile, which is 98% white, 0.1% black, 0.4% Asian, 0.6% Hispanic, 0.3% Native America, with a serious crime rate of 1,607 per 100,000 population. Property crime is at 475 per 100,000 population, with 47% registered Democrats, 48% registered Republicans, 1% registered Independents, and 1% registered Libertarians. And based upon that criteria, he takes that county and grades it. Tells you, okay, here's what your chances are. Now, that's not the only criteria. It's also how far downwind is it from a potential nuclear bomb site, let's say, or a target in, say, New York City, or. And putting these factors together, he comes to a conclusion. This is a good place to be, it's a mediocre place to be, or it's a bad place to be when nuclear bomb war attacks, or when this attack occurs. Now, the thrust of the book isn't just nuclear attacks. It also covers tornadoes, hurricanes, natural disasters, earthquakes, and so on, civil unrest and civil disorder. There's a wide range of potential problems in addition to nuclear bomb war. But in this series of programs, I wanted to zero in on nuclear bomb war and its survivability, because most people believe that nuclear bomb war is not survivable. Don't believe it. The Russians don't believe it. The Chinese don't believe it. And people in the military and people in the highest echelons of our government don't believe it either. You can rest assured that the President, the Congress, the Supreme Court, and all of the military at the highest levels believe that they can survive nuclear war. Now, if it's good for the President, the Congress, and the Supreme Court, and the military of America to survive nuclear war, what's wrong with a truck driver driving truck for Walmart surviving this same nuclear war? What's wrong with housewives with children that are living in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles? What's wrong with you people surviving nuclear war? I would contend that if it's good for the President, it's good for you and it's good for me. The book again, Strategic Relocation, Joel M. Skousen. All right, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk in the law. Our website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience in the Law Hour. Is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.